Get ready to start the second day of the commission meeting. My name's Jim Kellogg. I'm president of the commission from Discovery Bay. Second to my left is Richard Rogers, commissioner and vice chairman from Santa Barbara. Next to Richard is Michael Sutton, commissioner from Monterey. And thank you, Michael, for the awesome event you put on for us last night. It was very nice. And then on my immediate right is Jack Bayless, our commissioner from Los Angeles. On my immediate left is Sankey Master, our executive director. And at the end is John Fisher, our deputy executive director. Next to John is Rick Thalhammer, our deputy attorney general. And then we have Sherry Fombuena and Anita Biederman from our staff. Out in the audience, we have Greg Schumann. And on my far right, we have the director of the Department of Fish and Game, Chuck Bonham. And with Chuck is Dan Paraguay, our acting director of wildlife and fisheries. And in the audience, we also have with us Maria Vokovich, from the Marine Division. We have Captain Don Kelly. Here with our wardens, Matt Gill and Sarah Weiner. So with that, we're going to change up the agenda a little bit because of a couple commissioners that have to catch flights. And we're going to do what Sankey says.
All right. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for that kind of power, Jim. I would recommend that we move agenda item 18, which is the abalone item, and the consent calendar in 1-2 order, since those are decision items and we're probably going to lose quorum. So if that's all right, we'll start with item 18, which is a discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to section 29.15. Regarding abalone, and Ian Taniguchi will give us a reminder of what we're here for and an update. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ian Taniguchi. I am, they'll call me a staff environmental scientist now for a Marine Region Department of Fish and Game. As you know from the item, today we are have further discussion and possible adoption of the abalone regulations, and my purpose today is to help clarify the implications of the recent events to the Northern California red abalone fishery with respects to the current regulatory package. Hopefully this will be a help to you further discussing deciding on the regulatory alternatives and give you an insight on how we plan to proceed with abalone management in the future. So what I'd like to do in this presentation today is cover 3 points. First, I'd like to give you an update on the invertebrate die-off event and discuss the impact of the event on abalone stocks with its implications for fishery management. And finally, to discuss what are next steps in the near term and long term for the abalone fishery and the management of the fishery. So with that, the latest on the invertebrate die-off. As I reported to you last time, we think that the cause of the die-off is from a toxic poisoning from the red tide. We know that the most abundant phytoplankton species in the bloom was Gonialex spinifera, which is known to create a biotoxin called yesotoxin. We have confirmed from the presence of this toxin in the tissue samples tested for the toxin, albeit the levels of the toxin was at trace amounts. This trace amount was well below the European standards for human poisoning, so we don't think there's any problem as far as human consumption of invertebrates from this die-off area. What we don't know is that whether this trace amount of the toxin that we found is enough to cause a die-off. This particular toxin is relatively unknown, or there's still a lot of stuff they don't know about it, so they're continuing studies on. We do know that there are multiple forms of the toxin, and we at this point can only test for two variants in our samples. So there is a possibility that there is another form of this toxin that that's present in larger quantities that we are not able to detect. We are still doing some additional tests. We are conducting tests to look at the possible causes to the die-off. Our state pathologist, invertebrate pathologist, is conducting those tests. We also doing testing of other samples, such as sea stars and also kelp, to look for presence of the toxin as well. We have ruled out a hypoxic event, as well as withering syndrome as causes of the die-off. So, and at this point, we think that the die-off is over. We have not received any public reports since mid-September or so. So in assessing the impact, we are continuing to try to assess the impact of the die-off event on the stocks in Sonoma County. Unfortunately, weather conditions have hampered us in trying to get out and do more surveys. In fact, as of this week, the ocean conditions did calm down enough, and our survey teams were able to get out this week and cover more area. What you see up here is information I presented to you last meeting as far as the percent mortality from our three index sites, and I have added additional information from this week's surveys. You can see under Timber Cove highlighted, they did complete Timber Cove. As of last screening, they only had partial coverage of the surveys of that index site, and so we have an estimate of 19% decline at Timber Cove. Also added to that index sites is Ocean Cove, and we have an estimate of 35% decline at that particular site. To put this event mortality into context, we can compare that to estimated natural mortality. And we do have estimates of average natural mortality based on tagging and growth studies on red abalone in Northern California that we've done. And that estimate of natural mortality is between 10 and 21% per year. So you can see that our event mortality falls within or just above this rate. So you can think of it in the context that this event may have resulted in doubling the natural mortality for this particular year. To further assess the impact, we can also look at the average abalone densities based on the surveys we've done this year. What you see here is a graph of three index sites, Fort Ross, Timber Cove, and Salt Point, and what you see as far as on the far left are the last time we visited those index sites. So in Fort Ross and Timber Cove, we did that in 2009. In Salt Point, we did it in 2008. And the next set of bars you see are surveys from this year. We are fortunate for Salt Point that we were able to complete the Salt Point index site prior to the die-off event. So we have information from before as well as after. And you can see that it's possible you can see this decline from before and to after, that may be showing potentially the effect of the die-off. What you find surprising here is that the results show or reflect sort of the inherent variation we have in our survey. And if you look at the error bars, or this is what we call the 95% confidence intervals, our estimates are definitely not significant compared to the last time we were did our surveys. So look at this in a broader context. As you know, under the interim management plan, we base management on an overall average density for all eight index sites. Basically, what I've done here is taking figure one from the ISOR, which shows the first two sampling, three-year sampling cycles. So this is 2005 to 2008, and this is 2008 through 10. And this is the new information from this year. As you recall, last time I was here when I started presenting the recommendations for as a regulatory change package. The overall average density at that time was 0.54 for the most recent sampling cycle. Our most current information, using this information as well as the most recent index sites that we didn't visit this year, our average density has gone up to 0.57, but still fairly close. It's still not really significantly different from the 0.54 that I mentioned earlier. So you can see that there is a substantial variability in our estimates, which makes it difficult to detect impacts due to the event. So given this information, what are the implications for the abalone fishery and management? Well, we have definitely not reached the AARP density trigger for a reduction in the catch. If you recall, that trigger point is 0.5 abalone per square meter, and we're still slightly above it with 0.57. Based on this information, the fact that you have a regulatory package in front of you, we think that the existing regulatory package is sufficient to address any impacts to the stock due to the die-off event. This regulatory package remains effective, probably more so because of the die-off event, for taking a precautionary management approach to sustaining the fishery. Even though we have a slightly clearer picture of the event's impact on the abalone stock, there is some uncertainty still that remains as far as events, how this event may further impact the fishery and the stock. Thus, it is, if we get additional information for assessing the impact of this event, that may warrant further management action. We may come back to you with a separate regulatory package in the future if that is needed. So what are the next steps? We recommend that you complete the regulatory package that's in front of you. We originally brought this before you as a precautionary management measure because of concerns for further sustainability of the fishery. Those concerns remain and are probably more heightened with the added uncertainty of the effects of the die-off event. With that said, the department does have a recommendation as far as moving forward with that regulatory package. We recommend or suggest that you select alternative 2, which is the reduced daily fishing hours in the early mornings, coupled with alternative 3, which is the Fort Ross early season closure, and also alternative 4, which is simplifying the enforcement of daily bag limits. We think the combination of those three alternatives is sufficient enough to cover any potential impacts due to the die-off event, as well as our concerns, which originated this regulatory package. We believe that the decision for the emergency closure was appropriate at the time because of the impacts of the die-off event were unknown on the stock and the fishery. Now that we have some information and are in a better position to assess the impacts, we think the existing regulatory package will suffice for countering any potential negative impacts due to the die-off. However, as I mentioned earlier, if things change in regards to the fishery impacts with more information, we may come back to you with an additional regulatory package in the future, probably within the near future before the next abalone season, if that is warranted. If anything, this die-off event has illustrated the possible influences of the abalone stock outside of the fishery, and that may have profound effect on the fishery in a local area. This event underscores the need to move to the long-term management plan, and we suggest that we begin transition to that long-term management plan. That concludes my presentation. As usual, that's my contact information. If you have any further questions, I'm here and available. Thank you.
Ian, just for clarification, I think you meant options 1, not 2. Option 1 is the 8 a.m. Option 2 is the bag limit, so the public knows.
Okay.
So you're recommending option 1, 3, and 4?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Commissioner Bayless.
Ian, I just want to get some clarification on you, and it may be pedantic, but I think it's important. You're under the record. You said the die-off is over. Could you give a date when the die-off was over? Or a rough date? Just when you say something like that, as of when?
Well, as
of... Hold off a minute. I got a couple, a couple notes. Also, when you talk about the immediate percentages of die-off in those four areas, compared them to annual percentages, you need to show in what that means. You kind of ran through that. And I understand. I think I get what you're saying, but for the public record, I think you need to slow down and explain that data better.
Sure.
A second thing on the index site density, when you talk about the ARMP trigger, that's an insider knowledge. So you need to state what that is for this public record.
Sure.
So we understand that. And then on this regulatory package, is this for the Sonoma Coast? Is this for just the Fort Ross area, as in our notes? You know, what do you, again, for the public record, so the public understands what you're saying, what are we applying that regulatory package? And for the abalone fishermen, how are they going to know if they could, is it mean for Sonoma Coast or the whole state or what it is?
Sure.
So if you could give dates and add that specificity, I think we'll get there better.
Sure, okay. To begin with your last question, this particular regulatory package is meant to cover the entire fishery, not just Sonoma Coast. So when we first presented this to you back in June of this year, it was meant to be a precautionary fishery management change regulation for the entire fishery. And that's the way the interim management plan within the abalone recovery and management plan is meant to do, is to build any regulatory changes that we suggest as far as under the ARMP is for the entire fishery. Fishery.
So everybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Part of that, I guess, if you want a little more detail, is within the, as you know, within the regulatory package, there is an alternative that specifically goes for a site, Fort Ross, which our concerns are particularly for the impacts as far as of fishing and evidence of reduction in the density there at that particular site. We wanted that coupled with the overall reducing the effort in the fishery.
Great. So,
yeah. What was it?
Die-off was over by when?
Die-off? Well, based on information, you know, as far as reports from the public, mid-September, so roughly two and a half weeks after the event started in late August.
So what was that, late August to?
To mid.
Want it on the public record.
Hey, quit outbursting in the audience.
So roughly mid-September, so right around the 15th to the 20th, somewhere in that, the third week of September probably. So most of the.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other commissioners before we go to public comment? I'm having a little bit of a problem with this whole deal. I mean, this commission stepped up to the plate when they came for a request to do an emergency closure in certain areas because of the die-off, and we did that. But in lieu of how we're affecting the fishermen along the coast of California and taking away opportunity. And through past experience from the department gathering information about abalone, after we hear public testimony, we can all talk about this some more. But I'm not total trustworthy of in the past the department has come to us with numbers on abalone and after we've questioned how they got the numbers and where they got them and heard public testimony, we find that and maybe you guys didn't do it this time, but usually the staff people that do these studies go to the exact same places that there's easy access for the public where numbers are down anyway, because everybody and their brother goes to those spots. And if you get outside of those spots a little bit and use experienced divers that know the abalone places for their entire life, you find that the abalone numbers aren't exactly what the department is saying they are. So, I mean, this is the major thing, as far as I'm concerned, proposing cutting limits and seasons and stuff with information that we're getting in one meeting. I'm not comfortable with that at all. So,
Mr. President, if I may, we have discussed this at some length at the Marine Resources Committee, and Ian has been there the last two meetings presenting it. Of course, we began the discussion of these potential regulatory changes well before the die-off, obviously, and these are in the nature of precaution, given that we are approaching, we appear to be, you know, the population levels appear to be approaching the point at which the ARMP suggests that we are going to need to take action. The department is trying to stay ahead of the curve and propose potential regulatory actions that we might take. Even if we agree today that each of these is maybe warranted, we still, obviously, today is not the decision point. We're just, you know, they're just asking us whether we want to move forward with a package of potential action.
Let me make a quick correction. This is actually adoption of these.
Adoption.
Yes, you are here today you're better than you realize. Today's decision day.
It must be our new executive director is so efficient that...
And that's what I'm talking about. We're getting jammed with something that I'm not comfortable with myself. And I even though you guys are on the Marine Subcommittee, I don't know how you could be comfortable doing something today that affects so many people. And if we're not clear on how the information. Anyway, let's go to public comment. Thank you,
John.
I have Milo Vukovic, Paul Weakland, Christopher Lynn, Brooke Bowman, and Jim Martin. 3 minutes, Mr. President.
3 minutes, yeah.
Okay.
Milo Vukovic, President of Sonoma County Abalone Network. I'm going to start with number two. Earlier this year, we had a survey came in 5.4. We had a die-off. We have some more surveys done, comes back in 5.7. That just tells you the problems with the methodology we're using to count abalone. But no matter what, we're still above the 5,000 trigger in the ARMP. So I don't see how we could even think of passing that. It doesn't meet the requirement of the APA as necessary. We haven't reached the trigger we've already established. And until we reach the trigger that we've actually established, it seems arbitrary that we would pick another number. And it seems unnecessary as far as the requirements of the APA go. The 8 a.m. start time completely misses the target. It's totally, it's designed to deal with rock pickers, but it hits the whole fishery. It hits everybody that dives. It starts everybody at 8 a.m. How about if hunters were said, okay, you start at 10 a.m. now, because we're trying to deal with 2% of the hunters that are causing a problem, but the whole hunting operation has to start at 10 a.m. I don't think you guys would be ready to go for that. Well, that's what they're doing to us. Start at 8 a.m. when most everybody is a diver. You need to target the problem. And if you're going to deal with rock pickers, write a regulation that deals with rock pickers, not something that knocks a problem into the whole fishery. There's two tides every single day. And the way they did the analysis of this is they took out every abalone that was taken before 8 a.m. That means divers and rock pickers and everybody. And then they assumed anybody who rock picked in the morning wouldn't rock pick in the evening. There's two lows every day. If there's a low in the morning, they don't rock pick that. They can still rock pick in the afternoon. So what's the actual savings? Are we really hitting the target at all with this? Yet we're affecting the entire fishery and everybody that dives in it. And the calmest time of the ocean is in early morning, and many divers dive then. It's the best and safest time to do it. We support closing Fort Ross for the 2 months. We support number four, the regulation change on containers. They sent it to me earlier, and I helped rewrite it, and it's the way we want it, so we support those things. Hopefully, you'll leave out one and two and adopt three and four. Thank you.
Paul Weakland, Christopher Lynn, Brooke Bowman, Jim Martin.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. trustworthy, precautionary? Oh, it's a toxic poisoning of red tide that's special. Has never occurred anywhere else before. Oh, it's special and unique. But it's unknown. We're going to do more testing. More testing. Yes. Withering syndrome was ruled out. What about other types of diseases? Mutated strain. How was testing done? How do we guarantee, validate, and verify, double check? What percentage of error, chances of mistakes in tests and surveys? Oh, you have a new type, a way of doing it. We have error bars now. Yeah, you have to judge for yourself. If you take the error bar and put both the errors high and low and eliminate that, oh my goodness, it's a straight line. Error bars. You have changed the methods to gauge, judge, and evaluate conditions and status. Outcome, more regulations. Limit access. Less time during the day and less days. Only some information. Profound. I handed out a handout yesterday. I hope you all read it. I also have a study that was done by the, I guess I don't have it, the Department of Fish and Game. In 2004, 2005, they gave a presentation at the RAC committee, the Abalone Recreational Committee. And at the end, the conclusion was, it's not the question of if there be another die-off, but when. We know that the Fish and Game has tried to eliminate withering syndrome altogether. You've purged the files. You've changed the name. Now it's a wasting disease. When you try and look it up, it's not there. We know that you also harbor the outplantings, because there's so much money in it for your pals and friends in aquaculture. This just goes to show where you're at. We saw yesterday where you limited public comment on the yellow-legged frog. The yellow-legged frog is a classic example of what the department does. They think that they know more than what Mother Nature can do. The yellow-legged frog all died off. Your scientists harvested, over-harvested what yellow-legged frogs were left, and what happened? They bellied up in the tanks. Excuse water temperature. We didn't keep the water right there.
You need to stay on the subject.
The subject is the outplantings of abalones on the Sonoma County coast. We know that outplantings were done in these areas. What we see is he does not want to talk about the Trojan gene that was identified by scientists early on at Scripps. That there is a
time's
method-
up.
Yep, that's how the public comment goes.
Christopher Lynn has time ceded to him. Brooke Bowman, Jim Martin, Karen Garrison. How much time for Dr. Lynn?
He has time ceded.
Yeah, he has time ceded. So double it? Okay. Go ahead.
President Kellogg, Commissioners, thank you very much for allowing me to be here. I have a talk, PowerPoint talk. I am an avid abalone fisherman. I'm also a physician, a scientist. I have done a lot of basic science research in the past. I'm currently a clinical trial investigator. I lead clinical research studies. I have the ability to critically look at research studies and to analyze them. I'm really not here to criticize anybody. I am here to help you critically analyze the data that we have before us to make wise decisions. The Department of Fish and Game, in their statement, has proposed four regulatory options, which you're very well aware of. These options are based on what the department says is decreasing abalone density, indicated by the index site surveys, and also information from abalone creel data. These quotations, I think you'll see, are relevant. There are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And the second one may be more relevant. It ain't so much the things we don't know that get us in trouble. It's the things we know that are not true. Artemus Ward was a Revolutionary War hero. The department's statistical analysis of their abalone index data is incomplete. This has led the department to make premature conclusions and possibly to make unnecessary management recommendations, in my opinion. When we look at the abalone density, it's impossible to look at all of the abalone and count all of them. So what we do is we sample selected areas to approximate the abalone density. In order for the information gathered to be representative of the entire population, the sample has to be unbiased. It has to be representative of all of the abalone out there. The eight index sites that have been chosen for the index site measurements are amongst the most heavily dived sites of Northern California, and the department knows that. The data that's being obtained for these sites is most likely useful for helping us to make management decisions about the highly fished areas, but it's really unfair to propose that the information there is relevant to the entire fishery. Oops. If you want to manage the whole fishery, let's measure the whole fishery. The abalone density outside the heavily fished areas is maybe completely overpopulated, or it may be completely decimated, and right now we really have no idea. There are accepted sampling protocols that can be used that are spatially balanced that will give us measurements without clumping of the samples, and it would indicate the health of the resource over the entire range. Now, this is, again, the slide that was shown as figure one in the statement. Again, Mr. Taniguchi mentioned the confidence intervals. I'd like to explore that issue a little further. But let's just look at this data. There's a very large variation here. The confidence intervals are between 25 to 50%, which is very large. And so the confidence intervals are so great that our confidence in these numbers is actually very low. If you look at this number, I'm going to explore that number a little further. That's Casper Cove. The number is 0.55 is the average, but there's a 50% confidence interval there. So the confidence interval means two standard deviations. It's also known as the margin of error. What can you exactly say when you have a large confidence interval or a small one? You can say, we don't know the density, but it's between the bars. We're 95% confident that the interval outlined within the bars contains the actual density. But you cannot say the abalone density is exactly 0.55. You can't say even that it's probably 0.55. And in fact, you can't say it's probably between the bars because there's still a 5% chance the actual density is outside the bars. So let's look at the quotation from the statement. Recent scuba surveys indicate the average density has trended downwards. The average density is now at 0.54, which is substantially below the 0.68. Well, the problem here is they have not stated that there's an error here. There's a margin of error, and it's not stated. And as I just showed you, you cannot state that the number is exactly those numbers. You have to state the range. So the margin of error is two standard deviations. This is a complicated formula. If you want to reduce the standard deviation, you can reduce the variability. Well, we have no ability to do that. We don't have control over that. But in the denominator, we have N, the number of measurements that you take. So when you design a research study, you can calculate the number of measurements you need in order to reduce the standard deviation and to have greater confidence in your numbers. So when the studies were done for Northern California abalone, power calculations were done, and my understanding from the department staff is that the calculations were done to a 25% margin of error. And that seems right because when you look at that figure, all of the margin of errors are between 25 to 50%. Generally accepted statistical significance, meaning that you'll have great confidence in the numbers, requires that you measure with a 5% margin of error. For a pilot study, you would power a study to a 10% margin of error. So really, if we were going to correctly power the abalone density studies to reach a 5% margin of error, we'd probably have to do 25 times more measurements than have been done. Now that, we all realize, is physically impossible. The ocean doesn't comply with us. It costs a huge amount of money to make those measurements, so I realize I'm asking for something that's not possible there. So is abalone density really decreasing? Is it increasing, or is it stable in the index sites? Statistically speaking, we do not know the answer to this question. The large variability in the data leaves us the impression that the decreased abalone density is strictly due to chance and not because of an actual decline in the numbers. Hypothesis testing is the way statistically that you would answer this question.
Okay, you need to wrap up because your time's up.
Okay. So let me just say the abalone creel data The statement says the abalone krill surveys have recently shown indications of declining abalone populations, and they stop there. However, in the ARMP report, the department was well aware of other possible reasonable explanations for this information or for this the results of the krill survey. So the explanation that the abalone populations are decreasing is not the only explanation for the results that have been obtained in the krill data. Most fishermen are able to get their bag limits.
That's it. You're done. Thanks.
Can we get a copy of your presentation?
We have it back there, and I don't have it written out, but the PowerPoint is available.
We'll get a copy. Commissioner Bates, staff will get a copy.
My name is Brooke Bowman. I was up next, but I'll give this gentleman 2 of my minutes.
No.
Nope.
That's it.
Okay. I guess that's it. My name is Brooke Bowman. I'm a recreational abalone diver, and I've been doing this for about 15. Sorry. I've been diving for about 15 years, and we dive up near Jug Handle on the Mendocino Coast near Fort Bragg. And we have found there's a lot more legal abalone now than were when I first started diving 15 years ago. I don't know about the small ones because we're not looking for them, but we dive with a 9-inch gauge, and we very seldom have a difficult time finding 3 9-inch abalone in our area. The one thing that I would like to recommend to you is to increase the enforcement, and I'm not talking about enforcement about whether your license is signed or whether, you know, your cooler's in the trunk or in the front seat, but actual in-the-water enforcement where you go down and watch the rock pickers and you kind of keep track on how many trips they make back to their car and whether their car goes back to town and it comes back in the afternoon. These are things that we see out there, and Fish and Game has slashed the budget so much that these poor guys don't have a chance. All they do is drive around and hit us in the parking lot and say, okay, let's see your abalone. And ours are all tagged, and they've just wasted good enforcement time looking at people that are really trying to follow the rules. So my recommendation would be to increase the enforcement if you possibly can. One thing I noticed about the gentleman's charts was it showed there was an increase in the abalone numbers between 2008 and 2011 before the die-off, and after the die-off it was very similar to where it was in 2008. So it looks to me like the abalone numbers overall are not declining. I have no problem with recommendation number 3 or number 4. If you want our abalone in separate buckets, that's fine. Nobody has a problem with that. I think we all appreciate an emergency closure. If you guys see a problem, step in, close it. Nobody's going to bitch about that. We all like that. We're here to protect the abalone stocks. We've been doing it. My parents did it. My grandparents did it. And we'd like the opportunity to continue it. So please concentrate on enforcement. Knock out the poachers. Don't be so nitpicky about whether you got this here or there. I mean, those aren't the poachers. The poachers are the guys out there with a boatload of abalone or a trunk full. So thank you very much.
I just want to make a comment. I mean, all of us know, and the abalone fishermen should know as well, that in the last several years, since Nancy Foley's taken over as chief of enforcement, there's been a huge concentration on busting abalone poachers, more so than ever before in the history of the Department of Fish and Game. So the department is doing everything possible to catch the abalone poachers. I just want to clarify that.
Jim Martin, Jeff Richards, Karen Garrison.
Jim Martin, Recreational Fishing Alliance, and you've heard some great testimony. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what you heard already. And we support the separate container rule, and we think that you did the right thing when you did a precautionary closure. I think it was a little excessive closing all of Sonoma County, but you didn't know how big the effect was at that point. So I wanted to mention, just from anecdotal evidence, I guess that's what I can add, you know, and I'm kind of a rock picker, I'm not a good diver, and we're managing the resource or the fishery to a standard where you want half an abalone per meter. So when I dive down, that means I can touch an abalone here and here. That's how far apart we want them. And that's my experience when I go diving, is we see that many abalone. I agree with the previous speaker that we're seeing more abalone. It's a pretty healthy resource. And Nancy's efforts on enforcement have really had a big effect. I think when they first started doing the checkpoints on the highway, they were 40% violation, and now we're down below maybe 10%. So the word's getting out. I wanted to really speak against the 8 a.m. start time, because when I took my daughter out going diving, I need to go out at a shallow, when it's real shallow in the early morning tides, to show kids how to do this. There's no evidence that there's less abalone. In fact, there's more abalone in the shallow water. So I'm not on board with this idea that rock pickers are a problem. I'm kind of a rock picker. I'm not a good diver. So I think for safety reasons, you want to reject that one. Again, we support the separate container rule, and I think, you know, you have great testimony to work with today. Thanks.
Jeff Richards, Karen Garrison, Bill Bernard.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Jeff Richards. I've been before you before on several other occasions. Member of Coastside Fishing Club. There's 16,000 of us, of which probably 1,200 of us are ab divers. So the whole weight of the 16,000 isn't behind me at this point. I am a consumptive user, but like most of us divers that follow the rules, we are not buffalo hunters. We're not out there to find the last one and kill it. My anecdotal evidence is that I've been doing this for a little over 30 years, and I see more abs than I have before. That said, that's an anecdote. But by nature, I am a degreed mathematician, a managing partner of a significant consulting business that builds models for a living. This is what we do. And Ian did some great work with some scant data. But as Chris was pointing out, the confidence intervals are way too wide to draw any conclusions on this. So I really support Chris's efforts to refine the model. Obviously, we're not going to go out and survey 25 times more than we can, but there is a technique known as hypothesis testing, which, again, is math geek speak. So Chris and Ian and I can go chat about this. But, I mean, fundamentally, when you have to get your arms this wide to have a 95% confidence that you're within those numbers, you have no numbers. The model is too vague. You don't have any conclusions that you've reached. But back to the four factors that are under discussion today, obviously support the separate catch containers. That's not a big deal. I think that's a fine idea. The Fort Ross closure, as I said, we're not buffalo hunters. Fort Ross had an extraordinary event, as did several other areas in that neighborhood. Deal with those neighborhoods, and that's fine. So again, it's kind of a beginner's spot. The 8 a.m. we do not support, because like Jim, I've got two little kids. I'm getting in the water, and the ocean is calmest when the sun comes up, as we all know. You've all been out there. And then as far as reducing the catch limits from 24 to 12, we do not support that whatsoever. Thank you.
Karen Garrison, and the final speaker on this, Bill Bernard. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Mr. President and members of the Commission. We recognize that the methodology for abalone isn't perfect, but the imperfections could work in either direction, and the data shows that we're very close to the threshold for action. We agree that we should stay ahead of the curve, and we commend the Commission on its emergency action. We'd like to see some additional measures, and our preferred package is option one, delayed morning start time, which reduces effort and may help with the problem of shore pickers taking undersized abalone and throwing them back. We don't see that as a permanent measure, but we think it's appropriate now. Option three, a reduction in the annual limit. And option four, the individual catch bags for each diver, which we think aids in enforcement. We believe this combination would be a precautionary approach that would help bring the fishery back to sustainability. And we also strongly support the recommendations to continue managing adaptively and begin moving now to our long-term management plan. Thanks.
Final speaker, Bill Bernard.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Bill Bernard, and as you know, I've been before you quite a few times over the abalone matter. Commissioner, so far in this process, going all the way back to the MRC meeting, I believe in October of 2010, you were moving in the direction of site-specific management. Each one of the process commissioners, basically, you've seen constituency supporting that particular type of management. And we still do to this day. Dr. Lim was going to get at that basically before he got to the end of his presentation. We were looking site-specific. And I think you're getting that message from the constituency. You know, we're behind this, and it seems to be a good direction to go. Unfortunately, what Dr. Lim didn't get a chance too much to talk about was generalized random Thessalian stratification sampling, if I pronounced that correctly. That's an interesting tool that can be developed with also within the auspice of the ARMP, allows us to do that. Basically, the message of it says that when you're doing your sampling, you don't clump your samplings together. You sample through a broad area. Unfortunately, I want to make the commission aware of this, and it perhaps has a lot to do with some of the deviation. Four of the index sites are actually clumped together, consistently one right after the other. Fort Ross, Timber Cove, Ocean Cove, Salt Point, they're all index sites. I think it going forward at this point, it might be safe to say that we shouldn't view these as index sites anymore, but individual abalone sites. The data we have there may be indicating a good trend of what's happening at these high-use sites, but to say that they are, you know, representative of the entire fishery range, that's we're in a bad situation there. And, you know, we're proactive about this. About the regulatory package that's before you, the no commingling of the container thing, that's a real positive thing. That's an enforcement enhancement. Everybody's behind that. Obviously, at this point, you know, since it's not on the table anymore, but to reduce from 12 to 24, we're not going to do that. We see that happen. The Fort Ross reclosure thing, maybe it is a good idea, precautionary on this one, but we do need some more sampling. We do have some time, commissioners, before we... So this might buy us a little bit of time. I don't know. You guys are going to have to use your wisdom and decide correctly on that one. Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Does that conclude speaker, John?
Yes.
Okay, before the commissioners have are ready to comment, the director, Chuck Bonham, is asked to address this issue a little.
That's correct. Thank you, President, commission members. I think I have four things I would quickly raise. The first is a thank you to Ian Taniguchi and, in fact, all of our department staff, law enforcement, science, and otherwise, who are perpetually asked to do more with less in the face of challenging scientific issues and natural resources management. So thank you, Ian, for a lot of hard work under a tight timeline. And the second thing I would say is a thank you to each of the presenters today on this topic. It's obvious you care about conservation as well as the use and enjoyment of the resource, so I appreciate the time you've put into it in your personal capacity. And I benefited from each of the presentations. So the third thing I would say, and this is directed to the commission members, is you know, the department will always be willing to continue to collect and analyze data, solicit feedback, even return to the commission with that next round of data analysis and recommendation. It really does come down to a question of risk management, though, whether the more prudent course is to stay ahead of the curve and put in place alternatives prior to trigger or not. So for me, it's a question of the department's willingness to continue to collect data and analysis, particularly on alternatives 1 and 2, which we are willing to do, versus a risk management decision. And the last thing I would say is it is very important, I think, for the department to tell you that alternative 4 enforcement is a highest priority for us, and that in our judgment, the emergency approach in alternative 3, I believe, towards Fort Ross is sound and prudent. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay, commissioners, keeping in mind that we got two commissioners who got to get out of here quick. So, Commissioner Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. President. The President and I are the only two commissioners on the commission who were around when the ARMP was first brought, and it was actually brought at the Kellogg Center, if I remember correctly. That was quite a while ago, some 6.5 years ago. I believe that the ARMP triggers are, in fact, themselves precautionary. That wasn't the way it was presented to us, Jim, back then. And I agree with that. And for those of you who have watched my participation on this commission, you know that I am biological baseline driven. In fact, I was the guy who objected somewhat strongly to the adoption of the ARMP at that time because I did not feel the biological baseline existed in reality. And there were a lot of work, as Ian knows, was done. I thought Khan was going to hunt me down in the parking lot after that meeting. So I am completely satisfied with the triggers that are inside the ARMP. And just to net it out, and agree with the director that 3 and 4 are appropriate and sound, and I don't, I am not going to vote for 1 and 2.
Anyone else? That's, can you give us a suggestion?
So may I make that motion, Sankey? Can you put that together into a motion?
Yes, I
which
can.
Which is 3 and 4 and not right. 1 and 2.
My suggested motion then is that the Fish and Game Commission hereby adopts options 3 and 4 as specified in the ISOR the department provided, and further the commission directs staff to prepare a notice of determination consistent with the approval and adoption of associated regulations.
So moved.
Moved by Rogers.
Second.
Seconded by Kellogg.
Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. That'll be recorded as unanimous, a 4-0 vote.
Thank you. And before, one more action item before we lose a quorum. Actually, do you have a little time, Mike?
Yeah, well, 5 minutes anyway.
All right. Well, if we could move the consent item. I would like to move the consent item.
Sankey, we have one public speaker on the consent item. It's Paul Weakland.
All right. Paul?
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, transgenic zebra fish. We know what a devastating thing it would be if even one was released into the environment. All it takes is one disgruntled student, one disgruntled employee, one mistake. The irreparable damage? Immense. But it's another grant-sucking ploy to get grant money for study and research. How much money and time has already been studied on these zebrafish? Lots of it. And what have the conclusions been? What have they found out? Oh, very little. But we found out we can get grant money if we keep getting permits to be able to study these transgenic zebrafish. Is there any market for them other than research? No. Would it be devastating to our environment and ecology here in California if even one fish was released? Yes. Let's, push to shove. What have they discovered from the zebrafish? They discovered they can get grant money. Grant money, that is what it's all about. And you're allowing this chance, this devastating factor, that destroying the gene pool and genetic reservoir of our native species. But you don't care about that. It's almost treasonous the way that you allow these outplantings to continue, that you cover up the facts like the California golden trout on its way to extinction because of outplanting, the yellow-legged frog directly because of outplanting of fish. You have another endangered species, abalone. Look what you have done, the cover-up, the crimes and the sins that have been committed in covering up these die-offs on abalone. It is terrible. Do not allow this to continue. What benefit and what real guarantees are there on these zebrafish. How come we don't get any updates on what they've discovered? Because there is nothing.
Thank you, Paul. With that, I have a suggested motion that the Fish and Game Commission hereby approves its October 20, 2011 consent calendar, item number 23.
So moved.
Seconded.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it, and that'll be recorded as unanimous 4-0 vote.
Thank you. And yes, we have a Mr. Sutton.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. It's agenda item 20, I assume. Asked for this agenda item to be placed on the commission's agenda for this meeting as a result of a request from local community leaders. Our practice has been not to name marine reserves and protected areas after people. And that I treat as a rebuttable presumption. There may be cases in which an individual is so worthy of having a marine protected area named after them that we make an exception to that rule. In this case, the proposal is to honor Julia Platt, who not only was a local community leader but a pioneer in marine and coastal conservation on the Monterey Peninsula. And to speak on this topic, we have three community leaders, Professor Steve Palumbi, who is the director of Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station here on Cannery Row, Dr. John Pierce, who's a professor emeritus of marine biology at UC Santa Cruz, and the Honorable Mayor Carmelita Garcia of Pacific Grove. I regret that Jack and I have to go to the airport, but I thought I would at least introduce the topic before we go and urge my fellow commissioners to give this a fair hearing and consider putting it on the commission's agenda for possible regulatory action at a future meeting.
Okay, we're going before you speak, we're going to have a 2-minute break real quick, and then we'll come back. Okay, I think we're ready. You can carry on with your comments.
Thank you very much. I'm Steve Palumbi. I'm the director of the Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford University. I teach at Stanford and here in Monterey. John Pierce and I will combine our time. I'll spend about 5 minutes, and John will take a minute, if that's okay with you.
Could I interrupt? I'm very sorry. Just so the public understands, everybody, we're on agenda item 20, consideration request by Pacific Grove City Council to rename the Lovers Point State Marine Reserve in recognition of Julia Platt. Sorry, I just want to make sure everybody knew what we were talking about.
Absolutely. And in fact, what we're requesting is that Julia Platt's name be added to the name of the Lovers Point State Marine Reserve. And the reason is that Julia has two characteristics that make her incredibly important to this particular area. Her amazing link historically to Lovers Point and the enormous effort she went to in order to establish marine protected areas in this part of the country well before anybody else did. This is a picture of Julia Platt during one of her most famous episodes at Lovers Point. The issue here was that the house belonging to the McDougals on Lovers Point had restricted access to the beach. Now, Julia was someone who came to Pacific Grove with an enormous reputation as a marine biologist, a PhD in zoology that she got in Germany. She was a civic activist in Pacific Grove and spoke her mind in a very pioneering way. In this particular case, she said that, pointed out that the state constitution doesn't allow people to restrict access in front of their to the beach in front of their houses. This particular landowner was doing that. Julia complained to the city council and the police. They would do nothing about it. So Julia went and broke the lock off herself. The owners put the lock back. Julia broke it off again. The owners put the lock back. Julia is here now with with a ladder and an axe and a crowbar taking down the fence. She laid the fence down on the beach, opening up to everyone's access in front of the house, and then basically said, I dare you to fix this. the fence stayed down. But Julia also put placards up all over town. This is the placard she put up in order to let people know that it was everybody's job to enforce these kind of regulations. This placard said, opened by Julia B. Platt, this entrance to the beach must be left open at all hours when the public might reasonably wish to pass through. I act in the matter because the council and police department of Pacific Grove are men and possibly somewhat timid. So Julia's approach to these sort of things was to go and do what she thought was right. Now, the problem that she felt was going on in Pacific Grove at the time was that the coastline was polluted. It was polluted by the canneries. The air was foul. The water was foul. Tourism had been driven away. She took the canneries to court. She won every battle, but nothing was ever done of it. She didn't stop there. She basically conceived of the idea of protecting small parts of the shoreline so that there would be a legacy left behind for the healthy marine life of Monterey Bay, so that when the pollution problem was solved, there would be something to grow back from. She conceived of the Hopkins Marine Life Refuge and the Pacific Grove Marine Gardens. These are some of the first community-based marine protected areas in the entire country. They have led to the Marine Life Protection Act. They've led to all of the many kinds of marine protected areas that this commission has put in place at the time. These were the first in California. They were done by a 74-year-old woman mayor of Pacific Grove in 1931, 80 years before anyone was thinking about these kinds of efforts. She left a legacy of this protection behind, and she basically established herself as a firm historic link to Lover's Point. Her house was there. She planted the gardens there. There's a brass plaque to Julia Platt on Lover's Point. Her most famous episodes were on Lover's Point, and she created the protections of the coastline that the Monterey Bay now has. It's for those reasons that her link to Lover's Point as a marine protected area is strong. It's unparalleled in the entire coast of California. She was the pioneer of all of these types of measures. And as a historic link, we think this is a very appropriate thing. It's difficult, I know, to change the names of things, but it's even more difficult to regain the history of an area once you've lost it. And so as a way of maintaining the history and the link between Julia and Lover's Point, we're asking that the commission consider this request. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next speaker, John.
John Pierce, followed by Mayor Carmelita Garcia.
I'll let the mayor go first.
Thank you. Is that all right if we go out of order?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, thank you so much. So, good morning, and this is my first time ever appearing before you, so thank you for the opportunity. My name is Carmelita Garcia, and I am the mayor of the city of Pacific Grove, and Mr. Palumbi has just shared some fascinating comments with you about a remarkable woman, Julia B. Platt, who was also the first woman mayor of the city of Pacific Grove. She and I share something in common, and that's the level of tenacity that we both carry in our position as being mayor. As a current mayor, I stand before you representing the community that has made this request. At the May 18, 2011 council meeting, the council unanimously approved resolution number 110-34 to present this request before you to add her name to the Lover's Point State Marine Reserve. This request does not come from scientists or any particular user group. It comes from a community that loves its history and wants to preserve it, and when possible, to try and memorialize the incredible individuals that have made Pacific Grove what it is today. Pacific Grove is a wonderful, quirky little town, and we have had some remarkable and influential women in our history. To name a few, Elmarie Dyke, who brought us the Feast of Lanterns 105 years ago, and it's still growing very strong. Julia Morgan, architect, who designed 16 buildings in the California State Asilomar Conference grounds, of which 11 still remain standing today. And then we have Charlotte Layton and Emily Fish, who were the first two women and only women who were lighthouse keepers at our Point Pinos Lighthouse. And then we have Julia B. Platt. And the incident that Mr. Palumbi shared with you, ironically, is the same one that I picked to share with you this morning as well. The interesting fact about the incident is that that is what made an individual challenge Ms. Platt to run for mayor. And so she did, and she won. She was elected. And the reason why I bring this point up is because, first and foremost, she was the incredible scientist, and she had earned her PhD as a community member prior to being elected as mayor. And it was as a result of her position that she was able to go forward to do what she has done by protecting the oceanfront in the manner that she has done. So I would respectfully request further consideration of Pacific Grove's request to add her name to the Lovers Point State Marine Reserve at a future meeting, hopefully one of the two that you have scheduled in November. So thank you very much.
Any more speakers, John?
John Pierce coming up.
Is he the last?
Yes, I have just a short. It's been both Steve Palumbi and the mayor have summarized it very well. My name is John Pierce. I'm a retired marine biology professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I taught and I did research in the kelp forest at Hopkins Marine Life Refuge for over 20 years. And I also was a member of the Central Coast Regional Stakeholder Group. And Julia Platt's Hopkins Marine Life Refuge, which she set up, was central to the rationale at that time for establishing a network of MPAs throughout the state. That was one site where we could see that fishes were bigger within it than outside, producing many more offspring, which was the rationale for the MPAs. However, it was determined that the refuge was too small. It was expanded to Lovers Point. And the name was changed to avoid confusion. I'd like to join the mayor and Steve and the city council of Pacific Grove to reiterate the request to add Julia Platt's name to Lovers Point. If done, the department, I think, would recognize two people side by side, Julia Platt and Ed Ricketts, who's got his name on the reserve right next to it, as among the most important people in the early part of the last century to promote marine conservation that we see today. So I think the department would be really proud to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have Sonke kind of just give an outline of what the history of this commission has been on this kind of issues, so hopefully everybody understands.
Yes, just to give some context on this situation, the commission actually has a policy about naming installations. And in a nutshell, it says installations shall not be named after individuals. There's two basic reasons. One is to avoid getting dragged into the politics and pitfalls of naming installations after individuals, as you can imagine, you know, with all due respect to the great work that Julia Platt did, we've had some other interesting names that ended up having to be removed. And once you open this door, it can become very difficult to manage it or control it. The other function was, the reason for the policy was to facilitate people identifying where these installations are by using geographic names, so it just helps reduce confusion. And if this is, again, just policy, but be aware you do have it. And if the commission wants to start entertaining naming installations after persons, we might consider looking at criteria in the policy that would help create some standards. Otherwise, the policy becomes rather ineffective. Just as a background, I'm not judging this request, just explaining what you have in front of you.
Commissioner Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you, Sankey, for enumerating the Commission's policy on that. It, as you might imagine, it's been fraught with all kinds of unfortunate events and difficult things. For those of you who are from Southern California, I'm sure you delight in driving to the Marina del Rey on the Richard M. Nixon Freeway. I mean, no political statement on that, but it's one of those things that things tend, and with all due respect, Mayor Garcia, things tend to get named after politicians who had little or nothing to do with things, but they had the power and people were afraid of them and, you know, honorific. Let's give them a name. And probably within 50 miles of this place, there's dozens upon dozens of those things where a couple of terms of office later, you know, the new senator or the new assemblyman or the new whatever is kind of looking at this old name and no one remembers this person anymore, and probably for very good reason. In this case, this is a very different thing. And I understand that. I would recommend that the commission take a look at not coming back off of our policy, because geographic notation is important to everyone. These folks here have suggested that we add her name, and that is actually, Jim, in my, from my perspective, sort of a twist on what we've done in the past, opening that Pandora's box, and boy, it has been that for us, is something that I'm loath to do, because we're kind of dancing as fast as we can right now, but I would not be against revisiting our policy when we, so that we can come up with some language, if that's possible, Sankey, where we can honor people who genuinely had a great deal to do with the specific event, in this case an MPA, the specific event we're about which we're speaking. I think that that would be a kind thing for us to do. It is safer for us to do a blanket policy of no naming other than geographic. But in this case, I think there's a little bit more going on here, and if it's possible to parse out that language, I would love to see it.
That's a good point, Rich. I mean, as we all know, a lot of naming things after people is ego-driven, and obviously this lady is well-deserving of what they're attempting to do. There's no question about it, but... We have an existing policy, and we don't have a quorum here to make any changes in it. So for us to have those discussions in the future on behalf of these people and their attempt to do this, I think we'd be good.
All right. And with that, that sounds like direction to me and staff to look at whether we can craft some kind of nuanced provision for these kind of unique...
I'm not suggesting, Sankey, that's going to be easy. I don't mean to increase your burden, but they bring up something that, frankly, I think we haven't seen, at least in my tenure of 7 years, I mean, we haven't seen something this unique, something that's this deserving. The others were sort of slam dunk, no, that's not a good idea, that person was there for an ephemeral period of time or whatever. This is different, and this, it spurs me to think that this would be a good thing for us to do.
Yeah. You know, I mean, because it's a state deal that involves us, there might be something else could be named in her honor that would suffice until rules are changed and can accommodate that. So,
whatever is your wish, Mr. President.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Mr. President, since we've made a shambles of our agenda this morning, I would recommend maybe we go back and
to public forum?
Yeah, okay. Pick up all the stuff we kind of passed on. And with that, public forum, John, do we have any speakers?
We have three speakers, Jennifer Fearing, Matt Raleigh, and Paul Weakland.
Hi, good morning, commissioners. I just wanted to take the opportunity to echo George Osborne's appreciation for the commission's support for AB 376. As someone who worked hard on that, we're grateful to have been in alignment with the commission and so thankful for agreeing to support that effort. I also wanted to just put on your radar, if it isn't, that the tragic events that unfolded in Ohio yesterday with these 50-plus exotic animals that were set loose. Oh, you were here, so you missed the sort of national surreal news. Ohio has incredibly lax laws around exotic pet ownership, which is basically any private person can have 17 Bengal tigers, as this person did, along with giraffes, camels, chimpanzees, monkeys, others. An individual in a county that's been on the radar of law enforcement for many years yesterday opened all of the enclosures, then killed himself, closing schools in that town, and law enforcement were forced to shoot over all of the animals that escaped. It really just highlights the risk to the public safety and the animal welfare of private ownership of exotic pets, which thankfully, because of a law passed here in 1985, we have very, very limited access to that here in California. But an issue that was discussed at your last meeting around a lagging implementation of a proper inspection of those that are permitted to have restricted species here in California. The issues that unfolded yesterday just really impress the need to act as swiftly as we can. The department will be called on, along with local law enforcement, to react to any cases of escape or crazed letting loose of something like that if it happened, and we would all like to avoid the risks associated with it. So we're heartened that discussions that have progressed at the advisory council since your last meeting towards possibly a consensus arrangement for how to move forward, and I just encourage the commission, when that comes before you soon, to move swiftly to develop a process there. Thank you.
Matt Rowley. Is Matt Rowley here? Paul Weakland.
Morning. I'm here representing the Monterey Bay Salmon and Trout Project, who has been deeply involved in salmonid recovery in the Monterey Bay area for 35 years. A critical program is our for salmonid...
Excuse me, sir. The Monterey Bay what project?
Salmon and Trout Project. It's a small nonprofit concerned with salmonid recovery. A critical program of ours is our salmon and trout education program. We call it STEP. STEP teaches the natural ecology of salmonids and watershed stewardship. The intention with the program is to inspire students and their parents and people connected to become model watershed stewards and champions of salmonid recovery. This is a K-12 program in which native steelhead eggs go to aquaria in the classroom, incubated, hatched. The students go on a field trip to the native habitat of the fish, release the fish, invest their emotion and hopes in the future of salmonid, their fish, all salmonid fish, and really develop a deep understanding and bonding to their local salmon run. Over the 24 year of the program, greater than 90% of the eggs placed in the classrooms are successfully hatched and released. The release field trip is the key. It's getting the students on the river, seeing the habitat, understanding the natural ecology, see it, feel it, touch it. It's a memorable experience, and it's extremely effective. These students are coming back to us as volunteers or seeking careers in watershed restoration, watershed hydrology, a number of related topics. It's taught in 90 to 100 classrooms per year. It's roughly 3,000 students per annually. So the number of eggs going to this program is about less than one native steelhead fish. And we have a large, enthusiastic group of and the teachers, salmonid recovery people, even the scientific community is strongly supportive of what we're doing and see no resource impact from the activity. We did get a preemptive ruling from DFG Region 3, the Bay Delta, this spring, that they would no longer permit the use of native steelhead eggs for this program. They recommended instead that we should use their hatchery rainbow trout. Conceptually, it might seem to make sense. It is the same species. The problem is that the connection is made when the student rears the fish, and it is their local native salmon run. When they release that fish, the connection is deeply made. These fish would not be able to be released in natural environment. They would need to go to a city, park, pond, some kind of water impoundment, a man-made, totally sequestered type environment, no connection to natural ecology, which is the intent of the program. The teachers that have been teaching this have told us in no uncertain terms that they will not continue. They will not continue the program if they must be made to use hatchery rainbow trout. The program will die. So our hope is that the idea could be reconsidered, that some kind of justification could be supplied, and that we can save the program. Thank you, commissioners and directors.
Commissioner Rogers has a question.
Sure, if you would stay just for a moment, sure. And Director Bonham, perhaps you might weigh in on this one if it's your will. I'm assuming that the children don't know where the eggs themselves came from that you are using in your rearing.
That's incorrect. They do know where the eggs come from. They understand that the eggs that they're incubating in their classroom are from the San Lorenzo stock steelhead.
And so simply the substitution of eggs would cause the ending of the program?
It would cause such a distraction and an upheaval of the accomplishment of the intent of the program that the teachers that elect to do this, that nobody's telling them to do it. This is a voluntary.
I understand,
program.
Even though biologically it's
the same species,
the same,
but it's the release. They also, it's a practical thing as well. They can't run two field trips. The kids are going to want to release their fish. They do a classroom incubation of fish that just disappear one day.
No, but I mean, if it could be the same thing, only the source of the eggs was different. The same exact procedure you currently do, but the source of the eggs was different.
Would
that be a problem?
We don't have a salmonid fish that we can release in our region that is not a native fish. There are no hatchery stock fish in our area. There are only the native fish.
Okay.
We have a restoration hatchery program that assists this, but the fish are designated native fish. Even though it's a hatchery program, it's not they're not hatchery fish.
Sonke?
Yes. In my previous job, I unfortunately have a lot of background in this issue. It has many complications. And what I would recommend that you work with the director and the fisheries branch chief in the region and see what you can come up with, because this also has federal issues, ESA issues, and
right.
there are some devils in the detail that what I would recommend is working with the department,
mm-hmm.
and then I think it'd be nice maybe at the next meeting the director could come back and kind of fill us in on whether or not we can accommodate you and the issues so the commissioners better understand, because it seems like a simple request.
Right.
I just happen to know it's not.
I understand that, and we do have the support on the federal side. We are moving towards permits there. We were hoping not to lose the program in the meantime, perhaps a memorandum of understanding.
The classroom, the Salmon in the Classroom project is a fantastic program.
I agree. And I have no problem with the using hatchery trout in other areas. It's just not going to work for us.
So. Yeah, I think you need to work with the experts,
yes.
and see if what you can do, and then coming back to us to inform us what came of it, if anything, and then see if there's other things we can look at. But
Director Bonham?
We would be glad to work with you to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
There are many policy and regulatory issues at play.
Mm-hmm.
These are fish of high resource value in their natural state, and genetic issues are complicated. Balanced against the clear evidence that helping to educate the next generation is how we build sportsmen and sportswomen and conservationists.
Mm-hmm.
So our fisheries branch director and I will figure out a way to talk to you, but no promises on what the mm-hmm. solution might be, if any.
We understand that it's a complicated issue and are willing to work with our program and adapt it if we can.
Okay, thank you.
Mr.
Any
President,
more public speakers? I'm sorry, Richard.
No, I'll wait till we're done with public speakers.
Okay.
But I have one question for the director that relates to that, but it's different. It's different, so we can wait for.
Okay,
it's your pleasure.
Well, you can do it now.
Last night at our gathering, Director, I found out about a population of anadromous fish in New Zealand that was planted down there in the 1800s, the late 1800s, and may represent the basic DNA stock of some of our rivers here in Northern California. To my simplistic view of things, being able to tap into that DNA base seems like being able to return us, to rejuvenate the DNA in many, just to add that extra, you know, pop. As we all know, DNA diversity is very important. And it sounded like a very interesting idea to me. And I would love to, not now, but at some point in time, hear about that. I know, talk about a regulatory miasma, that must be amazing, but because now when you're talking about another country. But it sounded intellectually and technically very interesting to me.
Yeah. So that raises three thoughts quickly, and thank you for the observation. First, you know, I don't know exactly what your dinner conversation was. Second, there is, in fact, a new book out in the marketplace called An Entirely Synthetic Fish. It's by Alders Halprin. And it traces back a lot of fish management around the country to California's Red Band strain coming out of the McLeod. Third, this is just a highly complicated, very scientific-driven genetic component, and we'll take it under advisement and be prepared to report back.
I'm aware of European countries now looking into places like Argentina, for example, where they took brown trout from European. Well, actually, it's on the east coast of the United States. They're doing much the same thing to rejuvenate European brown trout population. So, anyway, I find it intellectually a very interesting issue.
You're not asking New Zealand to bring back that glowfish again, are you?
Oh, God, you broke my cover.
Any other speakers, John?
Have Paul Weakland under public forum. Paul Weakland. Okay, I don't see that Paul Weakland is here. So.
All right.
Then we're done with public forum.
Thank you. Moving right along. Next item is 17, announcement of results from executive session. Mr. Thalhammer, do we have anything?
We held an executive session yesterday, and the commission took no specific action as a consequence.
Any questions from the commissioners?
Nope. All right. I have one public speaker, Paul Weakland. Okay, Paul Weakland's not here.
Okay, John, we're not going to even call his name anymore unless he walks in the room, okay?
All right, moving right along. Item 19, receipt of public testimony and proposed changes to Section 7.0 and subsections B, 6, 8 of Section 7.5 regarding Oroville Thermalito Complex regulations. This is just receipt of testimony, and Stafford Lehrer, Branch Chief of Fisheries, will give you a quick reminder about what this item is about.
So really quickly, Stafford Lehrer, Chief Fisheries Branch. Mr. President, members of the Commission, the Oroville Thermalito Complex is a very high-profile recreational fishery. Department of Water Resources has a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission license that mandates the development of a cold water fishery. Problems that have historically arisen is that it was in an inland Chinook fishery. That promulgated a disease transmission to our Feather River hatchery, so we started looking at additional species that did not carry the disease problem. The coho salmon was found to be resistant to the specific disease in question, and a program was developed in collaboration with the Department of Water Resources. In 2002, the department approved the stocking of coho salmon into Oroville Reservoir. There was concerns raised by our federal partners and internally within the department about escapement of these fish when high flow events caused a spill through the reservoir. But additionally, the escape of indigenous native coho stocks possibly impacting our native coho salmon along our coastal streams. The compromise was settled upon. It was the secured from Aquaseed Corporation in Washington, non-indigenous coho. But in 2010, all of the caution that was expressed by the federal partners and internally by some factors within the department did manifest itself. And fish did escape the complex. They were below in active fishing areas, and the public was restricted from fishing them. It put the public anglers in a compromising situation. They were actively catching these fish. And secondarily, it put enforcement in a very sticky wicket of enforcing a zero take on coho. So as a result of that, the department has instituted a couple of actions. All fish placed into Oroville through the DWR program will be non-viable triploid fish. From this point on, we're working with DWR to capture that, those essence of that. And so what we've come up with here is allowing the take of these non-indigenous coho in the Oroville Thermalito complex, which is off channel from the main stem of the Feather River, and this is where the active fishing is occurring. So the proposal for the regulation is to allow the five fish limit in this section of the Oroville hydroelectric facility, and there would be no take of coho in the river system itself. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions? Hey, we have public speakers on this show.
No public speaker cards.
Right. Moving right along, Sonke.
Yep. That brings
us to 21. 21, discussion possible adoption amendments to the commission's policy regarding legislation. Obviously, you don't have a quorum. Do you still want to discuss this or defer this to a future meeting where you have a quorum?
Well, we've been carrying this issue for so long because we couldn't come up with an agreement on how to do it. We need to have the full commission here for this discussion.
Then we'll defer this. I agree with the president. Were there any public speakers, John?
Nope.
All right, moving right along. That gets us to agenda item 22. As you know, we had before you a previous version of agenda policy to clarify how we communicate with the public and the department on agenda items. And since that initial proposal, we have what we're calling here part two. It's come to my attention as your new executive director that we actually have no guidance on how items are placed or removed from commission meeting agendas. And so what you have in your packet is some proposed underlying text that some ideas on structure on who and how things are added to agenda items. Again, I don't know if you want to discuss this now with only two or you want to defer this.
Commissioner Rogers.
Again, Mr. President, I think your comments on the prior agenda item would apply to this.
Absolutely.
All right.
We need to hold that off for a full commission.
All right. That's fine. So we'll move right along to, let's see, where are we here? 23, since we've done consent already. That is the consent. So the next item is 24, new business. Is there any new business on any part of the commissioners or commission staff that we need to deal with?
I don't have any.
All right. Any public speakers, John?
Nope.
All right. This gets us to item 25, commission follow-up meeting review and staff direction. I, at this point, do want to bring attention to the fact that under the MRC update, we had a presentation by Craig Schumann on several recommendations from the MRC, but there was no direction or guidance as a result. So we were going to bring this up as to discuss that, but again, with no quorum, I'm not sure what we do with it. In other words, there were several proposals, and at this point, we're taking the reaction we got as take no action on any of it.
Yeah, if I may, Mr. President.
Go ahead.
There were three proposals, and it is the intent, it was the intent, and remains the intent of the MRC to suggest those for full commission. And but again, we are in a less than quorum capacity at the moment, so probably best done, Mr. President, your decision to a full commission.
All right, and since the president can do whatever he wants, given the current lack of rules on agendas, I'll work with the president to figure out when to agendize this issue in the future.
You know, when I was president, somehow you guys never told me that. I feel cheated.
We were afraid what would do, that it'd go to your head.
Yeah. I mean, never mind.
Yeah, so my assumption is that one of the next agenda meetings we will re-tee this issue up for consideration by the full commission.
Right.
All right. Which gets us to the last item of business, an announcement of future meetings. Our next meeting is November 16th and 17th at the Veterans Memorial Building in Santa Barbara. And the last meeting of the year will be December 14th and 15th at Hub SeaWorld in San Diego. With that, I have nothing more.
Commissioner Rogers.
If I may, invite everyone down to because I don't have to invite Maria. She's there, but nor Craig, for that matter. The Veterans Memorial Building is right across the street from Stearns Wharf. It's going to be hopefully better weather than this, and we will enjoy having you down there.
Fish and Game Commission is adjourned.